Tonight, it's my pleasure again to welcome Dominic Shaner back to Many Rivers Books and Tea. I was just reflecting on the fact that some of us might consider the times we live in to be times of, at best, ill fortune in many ways. And yet, we can also celebrate the good fortune that we have by having someone in our community like Dominic, someone who has passion, who has developed passion, who has cultivated passion for sharing with other people that which we draw sustenance from. So Dominic has appeared here many times, and his wife, who's tonight awaiting the arrival of their second child.
Uh-huh.
So in a few days, supposedly, we'll see what the child has in mind for the exact arrival, of course. But in the meantime, Dominic is here with us to talk about an area that is dear to his heart, as he has demonstrated in some of his previous appearances here. And I'm looking forward to hearing more of his, not just the music, but also the passion he brings to his reflections on the music of the time period, the ways that life and music were changing in that time period. So join me in welcoming, if you will, Dominic Shaner back to Many Rivers.
Thank you. So those of you that this is your first time here at one of the events that I'm sharing, we're focusing on a composer, Francesco Canova da Milano, and the only thing in the program notes is a kind of biography of him. It's hard to condense who he is and how we remember him, and then also how he's been lost to history. He was a fascinating figure, given the title Il Divino. The only other individual to be given that title is Michelangelo, and we can all recall works of his. But Francesco has sort of been lost to history. The instrument that he played underwent a lot of changes. And what I'm exploring tonight are two books, and some others, but focusing on two books that were published much long after he had died. So Francesco died in 1543, and these books are public. One was handwritten, which I will pass around in a moment, and it dates to the late 16th century, and the other book was published in 1615. So if we consider that, it's hard to look back and see, okay, well, you know, 50, what is 50 years or 60 years or you know, however many years that is. But that's why I chose this instrument, which you may sort of recognize as a lute. The lute you see oftentimes in Renaissance paintings. It has this pear-shaped body with a bowl, and these are individual ribs, so small pieces of wood that are cut and then shaped around a mold. And this actually has two types of wood. One is yew, and the one in the middle, which is kind of beige or a tan, a light tan, is actually holly. It's just been kind of lost its color over the years or gained another color over the years. Yew being, it's rare to find a lute made in all yew. This lute was made in 1983. And yew was almost harvested to extinction in Europe, in the mainland, and in England, because it was used for lutes, but then also for bows, because of its ability to sustain this sort of degree that it was bent. I think today yew is used in medicine for to combat to fight against cancer. So anyway, the lute started out, as you may know, with the bent-back headstock, and that's the lute that Francesco played, six courses. But the lute eventually developed into this, and then after this continued developing. This is the lute around 1590 to 1620, 1640. This is concurrent with the theorbo, which is an even longer instrument that's tuned a little differently. And the reason that the lute developed into this was because around that time opera was developed or invented. There is a group of scholars, intellectuals, artists called the Florentine Camerata, and they gathered and talked about the trends in not only music but in history and poetry, and advocated for like a return to the Greek ideal of what drama was, how music was to accompany the voice, and what they determined was very simple accompaniment and a single line. Because if you're familiar with Renaissance music, you have multiple lines weaving in and out, all singing the same text, but a little displaced. You don't have everyone singing the same syllable at the same time. So you have very beautiful music that's all this counterpoint weaving in and out, but I mean, you probably, if you lived during the time, you would know what they were singing because of, there are parts of the mass or popular tunes that everyone knew, but it would be hard to follow a single line. The poetry would be lost to the music. So this instrument was developed to offer support to a single voice. Chords and basses. The most important thing at the time was the text. So this was a change from music for music's sake to a focus on the poetry and the text. That was the most important thing. And so the reason I'm bringing this instrument in tonight is because even though music had changed, so we have Renaissance music and then Baroque music. So music had changed from the Renaissance to the Baroque. I mean, these are kind of fluid things. There's not a concrete date, or you have these trends that happen. So the music had changed. The instrument had undergone many changes, and yet we still find this old music, Francesco's music, still being published. It's being published in a time that the music isn't really popular anymore. It's being published in a time where the lute of Francesco wouldn't really be seen anymore. Another reason for the enlargement of the lutes is just to have a larger sound, a fuller, louder sound. It's not as delicate as a small lute. And it's interesting to think about why someone would guard Francesco's music, would go through the effort of keeping a book around, keeping a manuscript around, and then either handwriting it out again and again, or going through the effort of printing something that probably wouldn't bring in a lot of money. Not a lot of people would buy it. Most people didn't have the instruments to play that music on. And Francesco is really the only composer where his music is republished in both print and manuscript form in the amount that it was the many years after he had died. I have a list of how late his music was published and when it was published, and I'll play some of that here. But I think it's telling of his legacy, like who he was as a composer and who he was as just kind of a mythological figure. Also during his life, he was called Il Divino, as I said, but also compared to Apollo and Orpheus. And that's given, you really understand the meaning of Francesco being given that title, and then this, about a generation after he had died, then we have the whole sort of musical trend is to look back to the ancient Greek myths. The first operas were written depicting Greek stories. And so this is something that's really in the forefront, that is taken really seriously, and people are really passionate about the Greek mythology and this sort of storytelling, and what it means to call someone Apollo or Orpheus wasn't just kind of a pat on the back, but it's a really significant gesture. So I think that may be enough talking. The pieces that I chose, I sort of collaged into little suites, because Elias Mertel, who published the second volume, the volume from 1615, he writes in his introduction that here I have collected pieces, some which fill the hand, meaning really, really dense and difficult, and some which please the ear. And what he's talking about is he has fantasias and preludes, which is the old style, which are the ones that fill the hand, and then he has these lighter dances, which was sort of popular at the time. If we think of a Baroque suite, you have a jig, a saraband, these little dances that they're not just because it's a dance doesn't mean it's simple. You have a lot of variation, and you can have a lot of technical passages. But the tune is essentially a single tune with a bass line, instead of having multiple lines weave in and out. So Elias Mertel is clear about he has this old style and this new style, because he believes part of his mission is to continue to make available this old music that he had collected during his lifetime and found very appealing and really of the highest art. So while I play this first piece, I will. I have a facsimile of the Siena manuscript that I'll pass out now, and you can look through it. And this piece is actually from the Siena manuscript. And when it was published during Francesco's lifetime, it was published as the Fantasia del Divino, so the Divine Francesco. The most beautiful and divine, or something like that, whatever the Italian is. But anyway, in the index of the Siena manuscript, so bear in mind that this was all copied by a single individual. You can tell by the hand, the penmanship, that it's unchanged throughout the manuscript. And when this book was published, I think in the 80s, 88, it was given an early date. That has been since most scholars believe what I wrote, 1590 or even a little later. But if you look at the index, the musicologist that compiled this found concordances, so matched pieces to printed books from earlier in the century. And you look that not only Francesco's pieces are rewritten here, but you have a lot of other composers, some very famous, some Piero. Pierino Fiorentino was Francesco's student. You have Giovanni Maria da Crema, which was probably almost just as famous as Francesco.
Anybody named Mondaro?
Actually, no, but this is around his time. Yeah. Because Alonso Mudara was a vihuela composer in Spain, so his music didn't really...
A little far away.
Yeah, it didn't really get into... This is all okay. Italian music.
Oh, yeah.
But you do have some French composers. But what's significant is from all these other composers, you have four pieces, five pieces, and then here's Francesco's list. So just by looking at that, you get an idea of what's contained within this this manuscript.
Would a lute have been very expensive?
Yes. It would have, most people just, if you, Francesco worked in the papal court, so his lute, I mean, he didn't, any music he published he didn't own, it was the property of the papacy. So that sort of, and that wasn't unique to the papal court, there were wealthy families at the time that employed lutenists, and the same thing would happen, is the lutenist would publish a work in hopes to just pleasing their patron or who they work for. And lutes were expensive. A lot of times you have, for example, this lute, if you imagine this lute in the 1590s, the luthier, the lute maker, would not have just built this. So if I was, if I was born in 1570 and I started on an 8-course lute, and then by the time, I'm 40 or 50, the style had changed, I wouldn't be able to go out and afford a new lute. I would take it to the luthier. He'd rip off the bridge, kind of stack a neck on here, and make all these changes. So the lutes that survive today have undergone, numerous kind of rebuilding or modifications. We only have a very few instruments that survive sort of untouched, that they survive in the manner that they were initially built, and those are mostly 13-course Baroque lutes, those which are the last lutes, in the history of the lute. After the 13-course Baroque lute, the lute died out. You don't have any lutes after that. So you it wasn't modified into anything new.
So coarse means how many strings?
Yes, coarse means is paired. And the lute developed from the oud. So it came into Europe via the silk trading route and the Crusades. And the oud initially played with a plectrum or a pick. The lute took that technique and then eventually dropped the pick for fingers. And,
Where was that built?
This is built in Germany by Andreas von Holst, who still builds lutes today. And so this first piece it was first published, I have a list, during Francesco's lifetime and then long after. And all of his pieces are just fantasias, Richard. And the idea is that it's just sort of an improvisation within a mode, within a tune. And you'll hear passage work that's sort of, you have little melodies that come out of it, and then you have these chordal sections, some of it imitative, where you hear voices repeat. Some scales, but this is probably not a great piece to start with, but it's a beautiful piece. He sort of bookends the concert, the talk. The final piece of the program, you'll just try to have that piece in your memory, especially the end of it. The composer basically copies and pastes that the little scales at the end to his fantasia. So this next set I have, I played parts of this prelude in a previous talk here. But this is a prelude by Michelangelo Galilei, the son of Vincenzo, the brother of Galileo. So the Galilei family were a family of lutenists So Galileo's brother, who this piece is by, was a professional lutenist, and Galileo's father was a professional lutenist. Previously I talked about how Vincenzo Galilei, so Galileo's father, published a book of music wherein he attributed about 10 pieces to Francesco da Milano. This wasn't accurate. He took little bits of Francesco's pieces, rewrote them or wrote them into his own works, and then said that he discovered, you know, these new pieces by the divine Francesco, and this is, you know, to gain favor with those in his circle. Also, Vincenzo Galilei was part of the Florentine Camerata that I mentioned, the group sort of responsible of developing the early Baroque style and opera. So there is that sort of, there's all these little connections to, you know, all these lutenists that, you know, after generations after Francesco, and there's always little veins of Francesco in their work, or in their kind of either subconsciously or consciously in their writing. So in between this prelude, I will play a very popular piece of the, during the time, a Fantasia by Francesco. I can say that it's popular because that's interesting. How do we know what was popular? One way of telling is to see when a piece was published and then how many times it was republished after its initial publication. And so this piece by Francesco was not only republished many times as its the original version that Francesco wrote, but it was also turned into duets by two different lutenists. So they took this piece by Francesco and then added a second lute part to it. You can hear it's a little simpler than the Francesco Fantasia that I just played. And you can sort of imagine how a second lute part may fit into that. Thank you. So part of sort of performing this music is, you know, how do we know how it was played? Would you play exactly all the notes on the page? Because we have ideas, as you know, studying classical music, there's ideas that were sort of considered non-negotiables, you know, from the Romantic era, that, you know, whatever Mozart wrote on the page, or Beethoven, you wouldn't change notes, or you wouldn't, you know.
But he would.
Yeah, but he would. It's, if you think about, if you have notions of jazz and how jazz uses improvisation, if you carry that notion to early music and Renaissance music, I think there you have a more accurate idea of how music was thought of, how the role of the composer and performer, how those roles were mixed, and oftentimes the same person. Francesco, you know, was a composer and performer. And that description of him at the dinner party playing after, where he just kind of teases out a fantasia, you could imagine him just improvising. And in that manuscript, we have examples of written out improvisations or variations on Francesco's work.
Can you read that?
I'll talk about that in just a moment. But so, for example, we have on the page on this this prelude. That's just me reading the notes instead of something like this. Adding little ornaments that would have been, it's not to say that's exactly how it would have been performed, but that was, those are ornaments that were used. And then these chords that are just written as blocks, as there is a technique at the time on the lutes of arpeggiating or breaking apart the chord. So something like that. Break it apart so you create a little melody out of it, or you just break it apart like that. So taking what was written on the page as a foundation to add upon or to embellish. And what's written in there, if anyone plays guitar or is familiar with guitar tablature, that is essentially the same thing. Is you have the lines indicate the strings of the instrument, and the numbers indicate the frets. The difference in that is where the high string is for that, and on guitar tablature it's flipped. And then in the program, you see, so here this is an example of the Siena manuscript. I'll play this piece in this next set. Here you don't have any bar lines. The Renaissance idea of bar lines, it was just sort of a result of the printing press, a result of how music was printed. There were times where you do see bar lines inserted in manuscripts, and that's usually just to help the eye. If you have a whole bunch of notes, if you have a really long run of fast notes, you're just going to get lost, and so they'll put a slash through just so you can kind of guide yourself along. So the top system uses numbers to indicate where to place your fingers on the frets, and the lines indicate strings. And the highest string is what is the lowest line. And on this system here, this is, you know, the top is Italian or Spanish tablature. The bottom is referred to as French tablature. It uses the letters of the alphabet. So A is open, B is first fret, C, which sometimes looks like R's, but these are nice C's, is second fret, and then D, which is kind of curled, is third fret, and so on. but the same sort of pattern is in both systems. And the reason for that is you have lutes of all different sizes and all different keys or tunings. And so to write out a piece in, you know, if you had a lute in G and you wrote it out, and then someone else was playing a lute in A or F or E, then you'd have to rewrite it. So this is just a universal system. The dots indicate fingering and ornamentation. If there are any other questions, just feel free to interrupt.
What about tempo?
Tempo is not indicated. Usually, I believe it was much slower than we would think. So my belief is that the lutenists were better than we are today, so they could play it faster. But I also believe that the ear was more inclined to hear slower kind of weaving of lines. You have, what I don't have on this program are intabulations. So there's a practice where a lute player would take a vocal piece and intabulate it, put it into tablature. So they would play a solo vocal piece. There's very, very famous pieces, you know, for four singers by Josquin Dupré that then the lutenist would arrange for solo lute. And in order to do that, the lutenist, you have two things. The lute couldn't sustain sound as long as a human voice could, so you could play it fast. But what the common practice was is to add divisions. So if you have an interval like that, a singer's doing that, you could have, you know, the lute would add something like that. So you'd fill in the sound, so the sound is sustained. The line is still sort of heard, because the hearing would have known that interval at the time. But the tempo would remain that whatever the slow toctus or the tempo of the vocal original. So yeah, that's something that's debated. I mean, we don't know. You have composers that write really fast things, but most of those are sort of single line. They're not really thick counterpoint pieces. So this next little set, I have the Fantasia in the middle is unknown. So where I write Elias Mertel, he was just the compiler of this music, and he, let me see if I have his little introduction that fellow lute player translated from German. Let's see. So here he talks about why he chose that font, so to speak, why he used the French tablature. But he also talks about why he chose not to put a composer's name on every one. So he is not the composer. A lot of times we have books published by an individual that, you know, later people, we just assume that they were the composer. That's not the case. They are just the collector, the printer. And here he writes, nevertheless, I didn't want to give the names of the authors with each single piece, nor to let a list precede the work. On the one hand, I didn't want to preoccupy your opinion by prejudice, if it be so, as there is often wisdom to be found even under a dirty philosopher's cloak, that it has oftentimes happened that from less artfully obscure or bright works came something famous and prominent. On the other hand, I didn't want pieces to be ascribed to authors who are not their creators, for it is not in each case certain to me by whom a piece was written. But as experts will without difficulty know the style of educated people, it will be done here as said. So that's kind of a really fascinating insight into why. So very few, the Galilei piece wasn't named in his print. We were able to identify that by Galilei, because Galilei published that before the print in his own book. Thank you. Playing through all this music, you sort of, even though this piece is unknown, we don't have any other concordance, we don't have any other publication. The only place that this piece survives is in Elias Mertel's book. Books may have been lost, but the reason I paired these two is you have this little half-step motive. Here's the Francesco Poncia. Now do you hear it again? Yeah. If you start looking for it, it just pops up everywhere. And then in the Poncia from Elias Mertel, it's a little more hidden. Right there. You also have it where the interval is this go down and then up. You could either have it or, but that motive is throughout. So that sort of connects these two pieces. Whether or not the Francesco piece was a model for the latter, we don't know. But you find a lot of these little motives, so small musical ideas that are the that are used to compose a piece. So if you think of a fantasia, you have maybe a composer likes that little half-step motive, and okay, well, here's a little riff, and I'm going to use this little riff to compose this fantasia. So I'm going to figure out all the different ways I could play it. I'm going to add chords to it. I'm going to fill it out, weave it in. You know, if you have a series of singers, you could weave it in the soprano, the bass, and you have it throughout the instrument. And that's, I believe that was the compositional process of the time, taking little motives, small musical ideas, and using those as the basis for generating a larger piece. And the way that they would do that were, you know, governed by rules of counterpoint or how many times you can repeat a sequence or repeat a little phrase before going on to a new idea. And that's evident in this, in the Fantasia, in the Maritale Fantasia. You have that at the opening. And then halfway through, we sort of have cadence. And then a new idea starts. So you have one little riff that turns into another. Soon you have a full piece. And if you look in that book, the Siena manuscript, all the pieces are organized by mode. And going through that, there are some pieces where you have a piece by Francesco, and then immediately following, you have a piece by an unknown individual, but uses Francesco's idea, uses his little musical motive. So it's the practice of taking a piece by a famous composer and using a little bit of his piece to start your piece and see if you could finish the composition. So it's almost a study in composition. And that's... The most obvious one, obvious because the title of the piece tells you exactly what's going on, is he has Richard di Francesco. So Richard is synonymous with Fantasia. Richard just means to seek out, to search. And if you think, I like to think of it as seeking out all the mutations or variations of a little motive. So you have Richard di Francesco, and I played this in the previous talk. And then you have La Compagna, so the companion piece. And I'll pass this around. You can look and see how they start out exactly, and then this one, whoever, it's the part of the reason why this book is considered a really important source is because whoever compiled it was a very good lutenist. It's not easy music, it's difficult music, and the examples of where this individual takes a piece from earlier lutenists and then tries out his own piece, his pieces are very good, or she, whoever's copying this. And I'll just play the first opening line, because this is not really a rewriting of Francesco's piece, but a embellishment of it. So you have these little half-step motives, and then the La Compagna. Adds divisions or fills in the slow counterpoint with the fast notes. So
that's what I
So the next piece, I've played this one before. I think what I'll do is I'll just shorten it. I like to play this piece because it has an example of an early fugue, which was most people associate with Bach or Baroque music is when the fugue was kind of fully developed and we have a lot of them, but here's I'll just play the little fugue part, and then I'll perform it with an earlier Richard. So a fugue is where you have one idea, and then while that idea is, that melody is happening, you have another melody, another voice come in with the same melody, and they sort of kind of weave around each other. Yeah. here. It's like a puzzle trying to find all the entrances. And that's just the opening. It goes on a little longer than that. So I'll shorten this set. The Fantasia that I'm playing is one, again, that Elias Mertel did not write Francesco da Milano in his book, but it's just a Fantasia, and the version I'm playing is not the one published in his book, but the one published during Francesco's lifetime. So this next set is the fruit of the garden, everything else is the vegetables. I don't think I've played dances well, I don't want to get your hopes up. The first one's maybe a dirge or something. But these are pieces that were published around the time. You can see the date, and this is what what the style was. This is the popular music. This is when Elias Mertel, if I read you from his translated German. So here, I offer you as many as I could find in my books and have judged worthy. But some rather difficult. So for the first part, I give you nothing but preludes, fantasias, and fugues. Demanding a full hand, as the saying has it. And so that's mostly what I'm playing. And then for the second part, I have saved the most selected pieces, which amuse by their sweetness and their novelty alike. And they are the following un-Latin names be allowed: Courants, Volts, Branles, which is what I'm playing, Galliards, Passamezzi, and the like. And there he goes on to stuff the liquid honey and fill the chambers with sweet nectar. So the in the Baroque, you still had this kind of reverence for the pieces that demanded a full hand, those contrapuntal, fantasias, fugues, preludes. But then what the ear was sort of adjusting to were these pieces where you have a singular melody and a bass line, a simpler kind of compositional process, simpler, well, the pieces demanded less of your focus and just were beautiful just to sit back and enjoy. So the second one's fascinating because it's actually published. This is a very famous lute player and also dancer. He's a dance instructor. So all of the music by him survives from a series of manuals on how to dance. And so he'd have descriptions and diagrams of the steps that you would take, but then also tablatures of pieces that the lute player could play while you're practicing your dance steps. Your question about tempo, tempo is indicated in these dance pieces, which is interesting. The I don't know if you heard it. It has a. It's in three, so. And then the second part changes to two. And oftentimes that would indicate a change in tempo. So not only do you have a change in your pulse or your tactus, but it would indicate a change in tempo, three being faster oftentimes.
So I noticed that you're not playing those top long strings.
Correct. Yeah, I play, I think the only one I play is this one in the Galilei piece. And the reason for that, well, it's because the music, Francesco's music, didn't, this lute didn't exist. But this was the lute around when this music was being published at this time. So that's why, I'm not playing a lot of this stuff. The solo repertoire for this does use a lot of these open strings, but it's also written in a different manner. It's more an ornamentation of chords. So you have this kind of dialogue between the bass and the chords you're playing.
So it's almost two different instruments.
Correct. Yeah. And that's what's interesting about Francesco's music published this late, because we have this instrument, and really you're only using half of it. And even though the instrument had changed and musical styles had changed, there's still this this effort to republish or to keep current Francesco's music, to keep that alive. And this last piece does that quite well. This is a Fantasia by Emanuel Andreasen, and when he published this, I forget his dates, but when he published this, this was his first lute book, and he lived well into, I think he was publishing music in the 1640s. So he was a lutenist during the Baroque era, but was publishing sort of Renaissance music. He was keeping the old style going. And this is the one that has ties to that first piece by Francesco that I played. You may recognize it. It's at the end. This is a pretty dense piece with the full hand. And what I would suggest you listen for are these little motives. So these ideas that he seeks out and kind of strings along, and then he's kind of does all he can with it or is ready to move on, and then you have a cadence or an end point, and then the beginning of something new. And most always it's imitative, so you'll hear it once and you'll hear it repeated. And that is contrasted with kind of thick, slower chord moving sections and then fast single scales. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, if you have any questions, feel free to ask.
Thank you for sharing the fruit of your garden. I will point out that we have a donation bowl over there. We appreciate you contributing to it because we share what goes into it with our guests. And that will certainly happen tonight. And of course, we hope you'll come back and hang out with us when the bookshelves are back in their normal positions. And we can all get around to sharing other things with other people as well. So thanks again. That was really wonderful.
Oh, thank you.
And,
thank you all.
And thank you all for coming tonight.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, tonight was the tree lighting and all that.